All right. So I'm going to try and wrap up what Gabby and Ronisha presented to you guys, the Chicago experience, progress, outcomes, and expectations for the future. I have no relationships to disclose, no financial interest in any second, third, or fourth parties that I am involved with. And the purpose of my presentation is to provide an overview of the panel's presentation and briefly discuss the significance that Chicago, and specifically the University of Illinois at Chicago, has played in the advancement of care for those affected by sickle cell disease. And then this is just an outline of my presentation, the experience, Chicago's connection to sickle cell disease, progress and contributions, outcomes, comprehensive care at all life stages, and then future, transitioning group education and the cure. So let's talk about Chicago's experience with sickle cell disease. A lot of people don't realize that sickle cell disease has been around for centuries, but it was only described in 1910. So they knew about this disease. There are many names for the disease in other countries, in Nigeria, Brazil, but no one really knew what was going on with these individuals who were in pain until 1910, when a medical student from Granada was in Chicago at dental school at what was at that time Presbyterian Hospital. They drew a blood sample from this young man and discovered these odd-shaped red cells. And the physician who was working with this young man while he was in the hospital mentioned in his private notes, which we have a copy of his original document at the university, that the cells had a sickle shape. And so the term was coined from that point on in February of 1910 that this was sickle cell disease. The University of Illinois, and I'm going to brag about the University of Illinois because I work there, so of course no other hospital in Chicago can compare to us. University of Illinois became the first hospital in Chicago, and still the only hospital in Chicago, that was a part of the National Institutes of Health Elite 10. They started this in 1972, where they developed these 10 centers of excellence for patients with sickle cell disease across the United States. And Chicago was chosen as one of the first 10 elite centers. And we had the comprehensive center up until maybe the mid-80s, when competition starts to get a little stiff. Chicago Experience, the National Organization for Sickle Cell Support, was established here. A lot of people don't know that. It was called the Midwest Association for Sickle Cell Anemia. From that, the Sickle Cell Disease Association of America was founded, but that was started here with advocacy for patients with sickle cell disease. And then the final point, U of I physicians and researchers have contributed significantly to the advancement of care for individuals with sickle cell since the 1970s. And I'm going to go over a couple of highlights. So this is progress at the university and in Chicago. Epigenetic gene therapy, prophylactic penicillin, PROP study, which was the study that randomized children to two arms, treatment arm, non-treatment arm, with penicillin. They found that the children who took penicillin, none of those children died, but the arm that did not receive penicillin, I think maybe 10 patients died in that study at each hospital site where they did the research. For ethical reasons, the National Institutes of Health stopped the study and said, as a standard of care, all babies born with sickle cell disease started at day one, once we get confirmation of the disease, they all have to be on prophylactic penicillin up until age 5 to reduce death caused by, I think it's either bacterium or pneumococcal disease. But that PROM study is very significant because that's when the life expectancy of patients with sickle cell disease rose significantly. Many children died in childhood, so it was not seen as an adult disease until after the major PROP study. Hydroxyurea was a major milestone in the treatment of sickle cell disease, and currently is still the only drug used to treat sickle cell disease. The significance of this, excuse me, is that HIV was only discovered in the 80s, and yet now you have at least 20 to 30 drugs to treat HIV. Sickle cell was discovered in 1910, and it's still the only drug used to treat sickle cell disease. So the funding is not going towards this disease, it's going to other areas, which is very significant and a part of their perceived injustice that Ronisha talked about. Eye disease research that came from the University of Illinois as well. Pregnancy and sickle cell disease recommendations on pregnant females with sickle cell came from the University of Illinois. Baby hugs, which is a hydroxyurea study, UIC. Kidney disease, the research on the effects of sickle cell disease on the kidney, coming from the University of Illinois with Dr. Santosh Saraf. Psychosocial needs of patients with sickle cell disease, that research was done in the 80s. And I have those references in my slides, so if you want to look up those research studies, then you can. Metabolism of opiates, Dr. Robert Maloki and Dr. Stacy Short, significant research that sort of dispelled the myth of patients being drug-seeking, and I'll go into detail about that. The young ladies, I mentioned our acute care treatment center, which is the only one in Chicago where patients can bypass the emergency room. All of those pennies in the nose, the broken bones, all those other disorders that come to the emergency room, sickle patients are usually put behind those other things. But in the acute care center, within 30 minutes, we try to administer medicine instead of 8 hours. Stem cell transplantation, I'll discuss that as well. UIC is the only hospital in the Midwest that does transplants for adults with sickle cell disease. And then we have further research on hemoglobin F inducers, fetal hemoglobin, which I'll explain in detail. So we see the progress. What about the outcomes? So Dr. Joseph DeSimone in epigenetics. Dr. DeSimone started his research with gene switching back in the 70s, but he only published his first paper was in 1984. But he was trying to figure out, how do we keep the genes, how do we stop the switching of the gene from fetal hemoglobin to S hemoglobin? And so his research led to the development of the hydroxyurea drug being used for sickle cell. Cancer therapies are designed better because of his research with the 5-beta-decitidine and fetal hemoglobin. So outcomes, Dr. Mabel Koshy and hydroxyurea. UIC, there was a multi-center study completed with the hydroxyurea to see if it was the efficacy of the drug in treating painful crises. And the purpose of the study was to see if it reduced pain crises, if it reduced hospitalizations, if it reduced ER visits, and the drug does all three when it works. So that double-blinded study was significant at UIC because out of all the centers in the United States, UIC enrolled the most patients for the study. There's no direct correlation of quality of life for the patients on hydroxyurea, but many patients who are on the drug and the pain crises are reduced, they have jobs, they're able to get out and do things with family, they don't have to worry about being bogged down in the hospital. And some patients, the drug actually increases the fetal hemoglobin, which fetal hemoglobin doesn't sickle. So the purpose of hydroxyurea is to activate the bone marrow to produce more fetal hemoglobin. And the higher percentage of fetal hemoglobin in the bloodstream, the less crisis that you have, because fetal hemoglobin does not sickle. And hydroxyurea was approved by the FDA in 1991 as an effective drug to manage sickle cell disease. Eye disease and pregnancy. Protocols that are used at every major hospital in the United States and worldwide came out of the University of Illinois again. Retinal detachment, strokes in the eyes, floaters. These are some of the things that patients with sickle cell disease experience. Some patients who have had strokes in the eye where they had a bleed have lost their vision. And so it was significant that patients with sickle cell, especially patients with SC disease, that they have annual eye exams. If they have some changes in visions, that's an emergency to us at the university to make sure that they're, we can catch those bleeds at the back of the eye before it becomes a major issue. And then recommendation of pregnant females with sickle cell disease came from our former director, Mabel Koshy. Females with sickle cell disease are considered high risk because there is a high risk of spontaneous abortion or miscarriage. And so those patients, once they are found to be pregnant, they are given an urgent appointment in OB, and they are high risk. For the most part, many of those patients have to receive blood transfusions during their pregnancy, because when you're pregnant, your blood volume increases for you and the baby, but when blood volume increases in a patient with sickle cell disease, it's S hemoglobin, and so you have more crisis, more pain, and so we usually have to transfuse those patients to suppress their bone marrow from making more blood. So we just give them blood to suppress. Psychosocial progress, Dr. Anita Herdick looked at the quality of life of patients with sickle cell disease and recommended that those pediatric patients receive neuropsychiatric assessments to assist with education and school functioning. That was very significant because many patients, and it's also one of the objectives of Healthy People 2020, that we see a higher percentage of patients with hemoglobinopathies, specifically sickle cell disease, graduate from high school. Because these patients experience a lot of pain crisis, they miss a lot of school, and when they miss a lot of school, they have to make up work. They fall behind, and it's a vicious cycle, and we have many patients that drop out of high school because they feel like they're fighting against the system, trying to constantly catch up, which stresses them out, which causes more pain crisis, so it's just a vicious cycle. So with the NP assessments, we try to get the schools to do an IEP, individualized education plan, to modify their education. So I usually go to these IEP meetings with the parents as an advocate, and I suggest to school officials, you know, if the child understands the concepts, instead of giving them 100 math problems to complete, give them 50, as long as they understand the concepts. We're not giving anyone a pass on education. Anyone that knows me know I'm all about education. But we want to make it so that the child is not constantly catching up, because the more stress they have, the more they sickle, and it's a vicious cycle. And also, I have to toot my own horn, I'm bragging about everybody else. So in 2004, Shonda King developed the concept categories for comprehensive transitioning. I have the advantage of covering pediatric and adult patients with the disease, so I see the lifespan of sickle cell. Peds only see peds and adults only see adults. I'm the link in between. And I discovered that many patients at 18 were being kicked out, and I do say kicked out, no offense to pediatricians in here. They were kicked out of the pediatric clinic and dropped off at the adult setting. And many of them were not prepared for adult life with the disease and their parents. And so I developed the concept of transitioning these patients starting at age 16 to teach the parent and the child the tools of what they needed to be healthy and successful in the adult setting, which included things like guardianship, insurance resources, education, transition, and I think I have those categories. Oh, I think I deleted them for time. Outcomes, metabolism of opiates. This was a very significant study that really didn't get a lot of press, and maybe because of the outcomes. So Dr. Robert Maloki, who is a hematologist-oncologist from the VA hospital, in order to dispel the myth or help give some substantial evidence that patients with sickle cell disease are not drug-seeking, they conducted a study where individuals were given a dose of codeine, and they looked to see over 2-3-6 hour period how the body metabolized the medicine. And they found that individuals of West African descent were found to not have the enzyme at the genetic level to metabolize codeine to morphine, which is what the body does in order to for it to be in its active stage. So they found that a lot of patients, African-American patients with the disease, metabolize the drug at only 50%. And so this shows that patients have to have higher doses because their body cannot metabolize the drug to its effective level. And so we use this study to educate the ER and unit staff that, yes, patients are going to have higher doses of medicine more frequently because they cannot metabolize the medication. And so we were very happy at the outcomes of this because it gave us bona fide evidence that there some of patients just need higher doses of medicine. Not that they're drug seeking, but metabolically they cannot break down the medicine to its useful form. So future. Let's talk about futures. Transitioning, which is the process of preparing a pediatric patient to go into the adult centered care. Teenage patients are seen in the adult center to initiate the transition. So we try to do this at age 16 because many patients and parents are fearful of the adult world. And it's understandable because if you have a hematologist that you've develop a relationship with for over 16 years, it's sort of hard to say, now you have to go to see another doctor. And forming those relationships is very hard because you have a trust in your provider. So what we started doing was the pediatric doctors actually go to the adult clinic and we see the patients in adult clinic to get them acclimated to the setting. We have our nurse practitioner who also comes to the adult clinic to see our teenagers, and slowly we start to let the adult team see the patients and the pediatric team backs off. And this is the process that occurs over 9 months to 2 years depending on the complications that the patient may have. For those who have had strokes and who are cognitively delayed, it's more important to get the parent comfortable in the adult setting and teach them how to navigate the adult world of sickle cell disease and other clinics that they may have to go to, like neurology, nephrology for kidney disease. And so I identified these areas of transitioning. Medical in Chicago, that's easy. No brainer. UIC has the only adult established clinic in Chicago. But these other areas were not transitioning, so I've developed protocols on how to do the social and psychosocial transition, guardianship of an adult, the resource transition. At age 18, you have to qualify for disability SSI under the adult rules of the Social Security Administration. So those things have to be transitioned as well. Education, transitioning them from elementary school to high school, IEPs, accommodations, into junior college, four-year colleges. Patients who have cognitive delay, they're not gonna get a degree in neuroscience, but vocational school, transitioning those things. And then you have the final area of vocation and career. What can you do? Where can you work? Patients with sickle cell disease who have hemoglobin, as changes in weather causes them to have crisis. So maybe working a construction job is not the best thing for you. So I give the patients these tools. I actually have a vocational assessment tool that I use, and it's available on the State of Illinois website, where I do a vocational type of assessment and look at what they want to do and what they physically can do. And I try not to be a dream killer, but I for example, I had a patient who has had three strokes, and his goal in life was to be the top gun in the Air Force. Not gonna happen. But I told him, I said, you know, somebody has to put gas in that plane, and somebody has to make sure that the mechanics of the plane are working, because the pilot can't fly if there's nothing inside of that gas tank. So you can still be in that area, but you're not gonna be flying. You're gonna make sure that the person who flies the plane can fly. And so I try to use that to expand on their skills, but not tell them what they cannot do. Just say, let's just go into another area. Future group health education. We're starting a proof of concept pilot at the university based on the Centering Healthcare Institute centering, where we have support group during their clinic visits. And so everything is centered around sickle cell disease, but we have 9 topics that we're going to do every single month. So month 1 will be sickle cell disease and your body, sickle cell disease and nutrition, sickle cell disease and exercise, sickle cell disease and pregnancy, sickle cell and drug use. Even though you take medicine, which is considered drugs, there's some other things that you should not be doing, like drinking and smoking. So we center the education around sickle cell in a group setting, because we repeat the same thing in room 1, 2, and 3. If we have everyone in the same setting, they form a bond, they ask questions, and we get education done in a group setting with the benefit of them also having an appointment on that day. And it opens up the dialogue between the patient and the physician. Another model for group health education is the Have a Heart for Sickle Cell Anemia Foundation. And this is a very unique pediatric and parent support group that I just happen to run on the weekends, where I discuss the IEPs and the frustrations of a parent caring for a child with sickle cell disease. Parents are very supportive of each other. They give each other tips on how to raise a child with sickle cell disease and not spoil them and let them have everything in the world just because they have this disease, but to set limits, setting limits, taking care of them. When patients have to get a port for chronic transfusion, parents are anxious, the child, they're anxious, and so they support each other in this support group. And it's I've actually had this support group for about 13 years now, and a very, very good group of kids that I have to kick out of my office every other Saturday because they don't want to go home. Future, epigenetics. So we have physician, Dr. Angela Rivers, and PhD, Dr. Donald LaVale at the University of Illinois once again, who are expanding on the work of Dr. DeSimone to look at ways of stopping the switching of the fetal hemoglobin to S hemoglobin, which occurs at about age 6 months. So babies with sickle cell disease do not have pain crisis because all of their blood is fetal hemoglobin. Right around 6 months of age, that's when the genetic switch happens and the bone marrow starts to produce hemoglobin S or C or beta thalassemia or the D, the F, the J. And so what they're doing right now at the university is that they're doing research to stop that switch so that they never develop the disease. And so that research is ongoing, and it's very promising. So I took this quote from a newspaper article. Physicians at the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System have cured 12 adult patients of sickle cell disease using a unique procedure for stem cell transplantation from healthy tissue-matched siblings. That article came out in 2012. It's 2015 now. We have a total of 18 patients who have been cured of sickle cell disease.
Wow.
So, the program has been very successful. However, this type of transplant is for full blood matched siblings. And it's very hard and disappointing to patients who don't have a full sibling. If we had more patients with full siblings, that number probably would be double. But their research are now doing half matches so that mother, father, or that half brother or sister can donate stem cells for the transplant. The half matches involve chemotherapy, whereas they have to suppress the patient's bone marrow in order to receive the half match stem cells, because there's a high probability of rejection, graft versus host disease, which can be deadly. And so that research is ongoing, but for now, 18 patients cured of sickle cell disease. We're the only hospital in the Midwest that does adult stem cell transplants. Lurie Children's Hospital is the only hospital that does pediatric transplants for sickle cell disease. And so we have another 6 patients who are scheduled for a transplant in December. So maybe next year, if I'm invited to present, I'll have better numbers to show you guys. And if you wanted to look at that process of what they're doing with the stem cell transplant, the references are at the bottom of the slide. So in conclusion, and I gave you a mouthful here, since the first description of sickle cell disease in 1910 in Chicago, Chicago has been a leader in research and the care of patients with sickle cell disease, with the University of Illinois playing a significant role in the advancement of care. As new therapies and models of care are being developed, the University of Illinois Hospital will continue to lead in providing the best comprehensive care for pediatric and adult patients living with sickle cell disease. And I just want to finish with a couple of faces of sickle cell disease. These are the faces that many people in the United States don't get to see, the other ethnic groups with sickle cell disease. African Americans have the highest, we have the highest percentage of patients with the disease, but these are patients in other areas. These pictures were actually taken by Dr. Graham Sargent. Write that name down, because he is the leader of research in sickle cell in Jamaica. And so he's traveled around the world visiting sickle cell clinics and advising them on the protocols of kidney disease, eye disease. Dr. Graham is still alive in Jamaica, with a very cool accent, by the way. So he met these families in Palestine, Greece, Turkey. Interesting about Greece, where we have 1 in 12 patients with sickle cell trait in the United States, they have a higher percentage, higher than the United States, of individuals with the sickle cell trait. 18% of their population have sickle cell trait. Turkey, let's see. And so these are a couple of pictures that he took at the actual sickle cell clinics in India. My favorite patient in the top up there, he told me I could use his picture. I forgot to put that disclaimer in there. But he is of Brazilian and Pakistani descent. And he is one of the patients, I forgot whether it was Gabby or Ronisha, who had a quote, I think it was Ronisha, who said, "How do you know you have sickle cell disease?" Well, this guy right here had to argue with emergency room officials that he had sickle cell disease, and the comment was, "That's only a black disease." And so his mother came out of nowhere and just started screaming, and they gave him his medicine. But just to show that other ethnic groups, they experience that perceived injustice, discrimination, because if our Italian patients, our Greek patients present to the emergency room and they say that I have sickle cell disease, they're not believed. So the education still needs to go on. Nice picture in the middle of the mother and the child there from India, both have sickle cell disease. And I took the opportunity to put my own personal pictures in here of the sickle cell center at the University of Ghana, Accra, Kwale Bu, the sickle cell clinic there that I did research there in 95. And then a picture of me and my adopted mom in Ghana, where I spent time at their home while I conducted my research. So here is my information. If you guys want to contact me via email or call me, more than happy to answer any question that I can't answer. And if I can't answer, I'll get you to the right person. So I think I've gone over my time, so that's it. Anyone have any questions?
All of this, you know, so this gives me another bragging point about you, actually, what's going on. But I applaud your efforts to doing this, and I know that there were multiple entities in which you address medicine, education. Is there a spiritual component that you all have with the patient?
Actually, you know, that's the only thing that's missing. We don't have a spiritual component, but when the subject comes up in the support groups, then we approach it. We do have chaplains that see the patients when they're in the hospital. Patients are very spiritual, and we let them bring it to us instead of addressing it and bringing it to them. It's just a little hospital rule that we have to go by. Okay. In the back right there. Yes. Okay. Well, let me start off by saying that no pain crisis is typical. Even there's a variation within the hemoglobin types. So patients with hemoglobin SS, not all of them are in the hospital frequently. We have some SS patients who have never had a pain crisis. But as they get older, the sickling effects on the organs causes, you know, them to come in more frequently. So as typical as I can make this statement, patients with hemoglobin SC are not seen in the hospital as much because they don't have both hemoglobin S. They have a S hemoglobin and a C hemoglobin, which is another hemoglobinopathy. C does not sickle, as well as the D's, the E's, the J's. Depending on what ethnic group you're a part of, those other hemoglobinopathies are seen in other countries, but when you combine them with the S, then we call it sickle cell disease. Anything can trigger a pain crisis: stress, the weather, from summer to spring, spring to fall. It's the transition in the weather is a little rough on patients with sickle cell disease. A typical hospitalization, it could last from 2 days up to 2 weeks. Patients are given IV fluids, pain medications, depending on if they're allergic to Dilaudid or morphine. They are given narcotics to help with the pain. We try to, you know, get them to walk around so that they don't develop acute chest syndrome, because if they're lying in the bed, and sometimes breathing is painful to them, and so they take short, quick breaths, and they develop a pneumonia, which leads them to the ICU, because they have to be monitored. So from 2 days to 2 weeks, the cycle, you know, we have patients who have very severe disease, and a lot of people think that it's just manifest in terms of pain, but what's going on inside the body? You have lung damage, you have liver damage, you have kidney damage. Patients who have had strokes, that's another area, neurology. And so they present with pain, but the pain related to some type of organ damage most of the time. So that I think I did check. Did I miss one? Well, for the patients with hemoglobin SS, all of their cells are sickled. And so they're just circulating through the body, just like normal red cell stuff, but they're sickled. The cells are sticky. Round cells, normal red round cells, they slide over each other. They're able to shrink and just move about in the blood vessels. Sickle cells, they stick together. They form these adhesions along the blood, along the blood vessel wall, and you have blockage, which causes the pain, and it happens all over the body. You know, and so that's the mechanism, as much as I can explain as a social worker, I'm not medical, by the way, that's the mechanism behind the pain.
It's just a matter of time occur.
Yes, and so that's why we encourage them to drink fluids, because when you are dehydrated, you have a higher volume of these sickle cells sticking all over the place. But if you drink lots of fluid, then it kind of keeps things moving as best as possible. We try to educate the patients and discourage them from drinking caffeine products, because caffeine dehydrates you. And so we try to push water, juice as much as possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, you were fine.
Way patients metabolize opiates. You got your patient woman had a limited for the immune charge, and then also for six zone patients, especially as you're coming in. Is there a way to, I don't know, like, I've got a bad friend that wears a bracelet. Is there like a card you can keep in your wallet? I have this though. I don't, which I don't like this. Just when they go to the ER, just like that guy, I can do it, how do you know? Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that that you know?
We do have hemoglobin identification cards that we give the patient, and it looks just like a business card. That, but we don't put, we only put on there that they have sickle cell disease, what they're allergic to. We don't put like starting doses for emergency purposes, and that's where once again the perceived injustice comes in, because the patient who knows their body, if they go to the emergency room and they say our protocol is only 2 milligrams of morphine, but this patient has been taking medicine all their lives, they know that a starting dose should be 8 milligrams. That's when, like, oh, really? So you take how many milligrams, and how do you know this? So when patients try to speak up and advocate for themselves, they're seen as drug seekers, drug users, because who knows these numbers, you know, but they know their body.
Is that seen more patients that have insurance or patients that...
It doesn't matter. You can have Blue Cross, PPO, whatever. It's not just Medicaid patients. Yeah.
Are you aware of any programs in other places where perhaps they're at least testing out ways to reduce that stigma for patients?
No, it's just
some kind of interventions in emergency room.
Just constant education. That's it. I forgot the second part of your question. About the metabolism. You know, when we presented that information in grand rounds, a lot of people, and I think the guilty ones especially, they just, their mouths dropped, because now I've been perceiving these patients in a type of way when really genetically it's not their fault, because they have some type of genetic mutation where they can't process it. So it helped in the understanding of the disease, but after a while, you forget the education and you go right back to what you know. Yeah.
Wait, back then.
I am a researcher in the Department of Emergency Medicine at UIC.
Yeah!
And I've actually done some post-group that you're not part of. Rare disease, and perhaps we're in urban areas and, you know, certain areas of the country. So I think that's where the education comes in. There are, you know, so many diseases that are so, that are, and, you know, people with terrible diseases. But so the teen passport plans would also be transportable, because if people travel to more rural areas where the doctors don't see as much, and there aren't as many people talking, then this would be transportable, and there would be a call and stuff with the hospital service. But I mean, so we are trying to come up with some solutions.
Thank
there
you.
There was a hand somewhere.
This lady right here in the blue shoe. Sorry.
I'm a learner.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also in the position is willing to elevate or run for more payment. Often, sometimes the nurses are hesitant to give that bill of medicine because even if
yeah. You know, they're doing a follow-up study because they only tested it in patients with sickle cell disease. They think that it's in the general African-American population, so they're going to do another study where you have non-sickle patients like myself. I think the study, that's a good question, but I think that the study revealed that they still have issues metabolizing the morphine, even if it's given as morphine. Yeah. But you can, the reference is there to, you know, for you to look it up.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow. All right.
This was absolutely wonderful as far as I'm concerned. I hope that you appreciated the session and the information that was provided, and as well as the discussion in the Q&A that occurred. I think it was just fabulous. Let's give him a hand. And I'm very proud of our two students who, you know, came to me at the beginning of the summer and wanted to do a summer project. And this sort of just happened, you know, it wasn't like a thought out plan, but it turned out to be perfect. And I'm so proud of both of them for your first ever presentation at the American Public Health Association meeting, and I'm glad that I was a part of it. And as well, their mentor and my staff person who worked very closely with them, Tari Strickland. She's our academic skills specialist who provides support to all of our students in our program. Okay, well, thank you for coming. Feel free to come up and, you know, have a conversation with the presenters as you see fit. And, you know, we, of course, have to be out of this room at noon so that they can refresh it for the next session. Thanks for coming.